Wheels Across the Prairie, the story of the conveyances and roads which crossed the American prairies and Wisconsin's part in this transportation history. This program, The Road Builders. Host for this series is Dan Schutz, director of the safety division of the Wisconsin Motor Vehicle Department. Assisting him is Thurman Fox of the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. Here's Mr. Schutz.
Hello. I would think that axes like these would be more useful to, would have been more useful to soldiers in stationed in Wisconsin around 1830 than guns, Thurman.
I think that's right. And with this axe and the other equipment I brought with me tonight, we'll be able to build a road when the show's over.
We've been talking about road building or transportation, and actually it's been water travel in Wisconsin from the time of the canoe up to the sailboat and the steamboat. The Indians actually were our first road builders, the trails that they used in going from place to place, not roads at all, but really a path on which a man or a horse could travel, 12 to 18 inches wide, worked deep in the forest floor by the generations of moccasin feet that had traveled there in the forest and across the prairie. But they led to places and a man could really travel. We have stories of Indian courier running 100 miles a day on one of these roads, and that would put us to task on our 50-mile jaunts, certainly. But the Indian was a good traveler. He had to be in order to gather game, but sometimes he too wandered away from the locality in which he lived, and when he came to new or strange territory, he had to use different signs and marking of his trails to tell himself where he was and to let his tribesmen know where the trails would lead. And here we see a trail marking used by prairie Indians with a stone cairn here with another rock off to the left showing that the trail would go to the left, and here's one showing the trail to the right, and this would depict that the trail just went straight ahead. Now in the east, the eastern or forest Indians used a little different marking with stumps and then a branch simply pointing to the left and to the right. And here we indicate that the trail traveled on in this direction for 3 days of travel. They use different signs for different things to tell, for instance, that the hunting in this area was poor. If it had been a good hunting area, they would have had three perpendicular blaze marks on the tree. And this told that there was sickness or there a tragedy in the tribe as they traveled here. And here's a war, this is a war sign with a hatchet shown in the trunk. Or a red arrow planted in the earth would have shown the same thing. They bent saplings, such as we see here, to make permanent trail markers, and they tied them in such a way, then they grew like that. On the corner of Elm and Van Hise Streets here in Madison in 1920, there was a tree, and you see it here, that was a permanent trail tree. The limbs had been deformed to mark itself as a trail tree. When you go into the Wisconsin River bottoms near Mazamani, one of the first things that you see there is a trail tree. Now, the Indians followed pretty generally old buffalo trails, and while they went from place to place, they certainly didn't go as the crow flies. They wandered around, and they didn't cross a stream unless they actually had to. They avoided swampy places. They stayed away from brush thickets, heavy wooded areas. And so while they did generally travel, they were meandering around, and it would be the job of a road builder to have to try to, out of this, to build a road that went more directly from place to place. The principal Indian trails around this period of 1829 led out from Green Bay down along the Fox River to Lake Winnebago, from the north end of Lake Winnebago to the Wolf River, from Green Bay all along the Lake Michigan shoreline down to Chicago, and then trails came out of Green Bay and Milwaukee. We're talking about the period of the late 1820s and 1830s. Andrew Jackson was president. There were 24 states in the Union. A steamship of Savannah had just sailed the Atlantic, the first steamship to cross the Atlantic Ocean. And west of Baltimore, they were laying down the tracks for the first steam passenger railroad, the B&O. The Santa Fe Trail was open, and here in Wisconsin in 1831 and 1832, the first military road survey was conducted. This survey was made here in Wisconsin from Fort Howard at Green Bay, down along the Fox, coming to Fort Winnebago at the Portage, and then moving southerly and across near Dodgeville and coming out at Fort Crawford over on the Mississippi River where Prairie du Chien is now located. There was a desire, of course, to have roadways early, but we still were resorting to river travel principally. But there were other trails in Wisconsin that were being used at that time. For instance, Alexis Clermont was carrying the mail from Green Bay to Chicago in the period 1832 to 1836. That's 240 miles that he carried the mail. He also carried the mail from Green Bay down to Fort Winnebago. We helped to survey the northern Wisconsin-Michigan boundary with Captain Thomas Cram and his party around 1840. And he was a Durham boat pilot and a Wisconsin River steamboat pilot there on the Wisconsin River during that period. My, what stories a man like that could have told his grandchildren. After the Black Hawk War of 1832, Wisconsin took over Indian territory, and in 1833 they started a survey of the state of Wisconsin to portion the land out in sections. And from after that time, of course, roads came, bridges, and the settlers moved in, and we had civilization. Increase Lapham was a famous surveyor who came to Wisconsin in 1836. He had helped his father as a boy of 13 along in the east where his dad was an engineer, engineering locks there like on the Erie Canal, and this lad had helped survey in that territory. And he published his geographical and topographical description of Wisconsin in 1844. And many of his surveying instruments are in the State of Historical Society Museum today. I would have loved to have run along with Clermont when he carried the mail. I think I would. And I would like to have known Lapham and some of those early people. How would you like to have been a surveyor, worked with surveying with Lapham in the early days of Wisconsin, Thurman?
Well, I think I would have liked it, Dan, especially when I think of all the virgin rivers and lakes just waiting for a fisherman, and how I do love to fish. But I think that the work that Increase Lapham did and other surveyors in early times had to use the same type of instruments that a surveyor still uses today. And as we travel about Wisconsin, go along the I system, we see men still busily engaged using the same instruments that our devices look like the same that Lapham had to use. Now here, for example, a transit is a common tool of the surveyor. And those of us who live near the university campus on Saturday morning get a good opportunity to see the engineering students out with their transits that look much like this one does. This is the telescope, the sight through which the surveyor looks towards his partner. It has a focusing device and a leveling bubble underneath so that he can be sure that his eyepiece is perfectly level. There are other bubbles on the platform so that the entire platform can be kept level. One of the measurements that a surveyor can make is an azimuth measurement, the turning of the sight from one a known point to an unknown point. And it has a vernier scale along one edge so he can determine the number of degrees of turn. On the bottom of the transit itself is a compass so that the surveyor can readily tell the directions. Another tool that a surveyor has is the leveling rod. Now this is the tool that's used by the partner of the man who's using the sight. Now this particular rod is one that can moves up and down. The sight piece moves up and down, and this is what is sighted by the telescope. Numbers are on the inside, and it's possible to tell elevation using this leveling rod along with the transit. Another measurement that a surveyor makes in addition to the azimuth and to height is one that he can make in distance. To do that, a chain is used like this one. This particular chain, sometimes called a Gunter chain, is about 66 feet long, four rods. Each length in the chain is about 7 9/200 inches. There is at the end of each chain is a loop, and then it is connected with a link to the next chain. 10 squares of this chain would be equivalent to an acre. So it is an equivalent, an easy device for the surveyor to use. And anyone who has a property, a deed in which it describes the property being marked off with chain, well, this is what they're talking about, a device like this. Modern surveyors use a steel tape, an alloy of some type, to prevent expansion and contraction so they get a much more accurate measurement. There are handles at each end of the chain. It took two men to use a chain like this. They would stretch the chain out to its full length and then would put down a steel marker like this. Now this would be marked at one site with a some type of cloth on it so you would be able to see it readily, and then picked up another marker and would drive that in at the other end of the stake. And by a series of these along the route, it would be possible to accurately survey the land. Now there was another type of device that was used by the surveyor, and that was a blaze tree, and we have a good example of a blaze tree here. Now this particular one is a pine tree from Trout Lake in Oneida County. And on it, we can see the name of T.J. Cram. This was Captain Cram in the United States Engineers, and D. Houghton, after whom Houghton, Michigan is named. And the date is quite legible. It's August 11th in 1841. Houghton and Cram surveyed the Wisconsin-Michigan boundary. One of the tools that they probably used was this. This is called a race knife or a scribe. It is made, has two prongs. Some of them would have one and others have three, this particular one with the two. This had several ways it could be used. It could be shoved into a tree with the point, and then, of course, a perfect circle could be made using the scribe, the tool that's folded over. Or it would be possible to make Roman numerals or to put in a man's name. Now, this tool was used by coopers who would mark barrel staves once they had been made so he could fit the staves together again. It would be used by a lumberman in the forest who would mark on the end of a tree either the symbol for the company or else the number of board feet in the log. Or else it would be used by a carpenter who could mark beams and joists while he was on the ground, and then when he moved them up into the ceiling, he would be able to tell which pieces fit together by the way he had marked them. So this is all the types of devices and tools that a surveyor had to use. But now let's go back to more about the roads of Wisconsin.
Well, the cry for roads was louder actually than the desire for statehood, and this was real pressing at that time too. In the spring, or in the year of 1829, there was a meeting in Green Bay for a military road meeting, putting pressure on the federal government to try to get some roads in that area. Earlier that year, in the spring of, in May, I believe it was, of 1829, Jim Doty, who had long been pressing for roads and who we'll hear much about later in Wisconsin history, along with Henry Baird and Morgan Martin and an Indian guide, traveled from Fort Howard, Green Bay, to Fort Crawford at Prairie du Chien on land via horseback. And this was the first time that men had actually made a land trip such as this. In making this trip, they were pioneering what they hoped would be a road to Prairie du Chien. And they had made the trip three times before, but by canoe. But as a result of the pressure that was put on, finally in 1835, Lewis Cass, who was then governor of the Michigan Territory, ordered that a road be built to connect the various forts in Wisconsin. Cass, in addition to being the governor of the Michigan Territory, also was responsible for bringing roads and civilization to much of this country. But we see here the road that came through there was from Fort Howard to Fort Winnebago and on down to Fort Crawford. This main road here came through, this was the route that they were to follow. Cass later became Secretary of War and actually ran for president. But he ordered the 5th Regiment under General George Brooke, the responsibility of building the road, and in connecting these three forts and using soldier labor to do it, it was called a national defense system of roads, because it was more actually than just connecting the three forts that we've seen. It was also to connect Fort Ripley over in Minnesota and Fort Madison and Fort Des Moines in Iowa and Fort Dearborn, where Chicago is now found. But this was all a part of a system of transportation to protect the new settlers and to protect the soldiers, actually, that were stationed at these various forts. The road had to be cut, of course, through forest and across prairies, and it was specified to be a track 2 rods wide to be cleared. They had to cut down all of the trees. They were supposed to cut the trees under 12 inches, leaving 6 inches of stump. And if they were over 12 inches in diameter, they'd leave 12 inches of stump, and then to cup out the stump so that water would stay there and help rot the stump earlier than if they'd cut it in some other manner. When they went across swampy places, they had to build up, and they would put logs in crossways and make a kind of a corduroy road on which to travel. They cut away the sides of hills and graded them out. All of this was done by man labor and with a few crude tools, horse-drawn plows and that kind of thing. In Prairie du Chien in 1835, the soldiers there started building. They just completed this second fort downriver from their first fort, and they cut the trails and bridged the rivers worked through the building the swamps and bridging them, and it went in a hurry across that rolling prairie. There wasn't a great deal of forest, and they finished that part under Colonel Zachary Taylor in August of 1835. It was 110 miles from Prairie du Chien to the bottom of Lake Winnebago. We're told that after Colonel Taylor had finished this portion of the road, that he sold the equipment and the teams that he'd used in building the road, and the entire cost of that 110 miles was $1,200. Now, the northern portion wasn't finished until 1838, and it wasn't because the soldiers didn't work as hard, it was just that they had much rougher going. A lot more timber, a lot of hardwood to go through, and we're told that coming out of Green Bay, in the first 24 miles, there was enough streams there and ravines that they had to bridge 56 times. Well, that's a lot of labor, and they take their tents with them, and they had to erect huts out there for the men to live in during the time that they were there. So it really was a rough job in building this road in that under that kind of conditions. They were going to build it first on the left bank of the Fox, but they rejected that and went to the right bank, and in case you're wondering, the left bank is that bank on your left when you're facing downstream. So the road was built on the side toward Lake Michigan, and thus they never had to cross the Fox River at all, and came from Fort Howard down to Fort Winnebago. And Thurman has the orderly book from Fort Winnebago, and he's going to read portions of that describe this road building venture by these soldiers.
The orderly book kept at Fort Winnebago was kept by Lieutenant Van Cleve, and it's dated 1834-1836. This is part of the manuscript collection of the State Historical Society, and there is one section of it that I would like to read to you. I'll turn it so that you may see it at the same time that I read. This is General Order number 47, and it's dated May 3, 1835. The east section of the military road, contemplated in General Order number 20, will commence on Monday next, detailing companies for work on second section of the military road. Two companies, E and D, will first be employed on it. Company D will encamp near Dutch Creek and work toward the fort, making a bridge across the creek. Company C will encamp near Whitney's storehouse on the Wisconsin River. Company E will commence at the Fox River and for the present will lodge in the quarters. Now from Green Bay, a little different problem developed, because there the soldiers would work on the road for a week and then would return to their quarters, and a new company would be sent out to replace them. Now, of course, they did not rely on guns while they were working on the road, but rather they relied upon tools to build the road. Now, this is a broad axe. It is a knife edge broad axe. It has an edge much like any axe that you would expect to find. This is a late 19th century axe. An earlier axe would have a chisel edge. That would be one edge would be tapered, as this one is, and the other side would be smooth. Now, this was not used for cutting trees, but rather for trimming. A conventional axe was used for cutting trees. When it was time to use the broad axe, the tree would be placed on a stand, so it would be about the height of your knees. The bark would be stripped from the tree, and then a line would be drawn to the size that the beam had to be. Then notches would be cut into the log itself so that the excess wood would be cut away with a conventional axe, almost up to where the line had been drawn. Then a woodsman, using an axe, a broad axe, would begin his work. He would use short, sharp strokes, cutting diagonally across the grain until he would trim it to the size that he wanted, the exact beam size where he had drawn the line. Now let's talk more about the military roads themselves.
Well, by the 1840s, the military road was completed from Fort Howard down to Fort Crawford. There were a lot of other roads that had been built in there, from Sheboygan over to Fond du Lac and Port Washington to Portage, Milwaukee to Madison, Racine to Dubuque, from Kenosha to Beloit. And all of these roads had been started, and most of them had been finished in the 40s. But even in wet weather, these roads were next to impossible. I told you about the tall stumps they left standing, and wagons couldn't pass each other. And even so, the early travel on these roads was better than on no road at all, than like traveling on the prairie, which one said was like traveling on the open sea. In the spring of 1831, Juliet Kinsey and her husband John, who was the Indian agent at Fort Winnebago at the Portage of the Fox in Wisconsin, wanted to go to Chicago, and they left there in March of 1831. Major Twiggs, the commander there at Fort Winnebago, tried to discourage them not to go, but they were persistent and went anyhow. The ice was out on the at Lake Koshkonong. They couldn't cross the Fox or the Rock River at that point, so they traveled in a southerly direction to Dixon, Illinois, and then they crossed the rock down below that. But they talk about their travel, and Mrs. Kinsey had no riding habits. The regimental tailor made her clothing to travel on the journey, and the provisions that they took. They got lost, and they spent about 10 days. They left Fort Winnebago on March the 8th. On March the 9th, they passed Lake Mendota. Mrs. Kinsey wrote in her diary,
"Our road, after leaving the lake, lay over a rolling prairie, now bare and desolate enough. The hollows were filled with snow, which, being partly thawed, furnished an uncertain footing for the horses. Sometimes the elevations were covered with a thicket, in which our dogs would generally rouse up one or more deer. It was about the middle of the afternoon when we reached the Blue Mound. I rejoiced much to have gotten so far, for I was sadly fatigued, and every mile now seemed like two, when I was told we still had 7 miles to go to Morrison's, where we proposed stopping for the night. I was almost in despair. The next morning, my husband and I continued our route to Chicago. There seemed to be some apprehension, however, that we might have difficulty in striking the trail to Hamilton's Diggings, our next point of destination. Our directions were obscure. We were to pursue a given trail for a certain number of miles when we should come to a crossing into which we were to turn, taking an easterly direction. After a time, this would bring us to a deep trail leading straight to Hamilton's. In this open country, there are no landmarks. One elevation is so exactly like another that if you lose your trail, there is almost as little hope of regaining it as of finding a pathway in the midst of the ocean. The trail, it must be remembered, is not a broad highway, but a narrow path deeply indented by the hooves of the horses on which the Indians travel in single file. So deeply is it sunk into the sod which covers the prairies that it is difficult sometimes to distinguish it at a distance of a few rods. Here and there are oblong openings in the prairie like gigantic graves which mark an unsuccessful search for indications of a lead mine. Once in a while, a gaunt prairie wolf peers over the nearest rising ground, seems to dare us on to an encounter."
Well, the Kinseys were lost, and they camped for the night not knowing where they were. During the night, a storm came up. It knocked down their tent. They arose in the morning. It was still snowing. But finally, after wandering around, one of the chief guide to their party cried out, "Unclotur, a fence, a fence," and they knew that they had arrived at Hamilton's. Juliet Kinsey tells about this in her book, Wah Bun, which is taken from her diary. But the newly finished roads were better than no road at all, but we were talking about how muddy they were, and someone described them as, when they were muddy, as slippery as noodles in a spoon. And the main street of Fond du Lac was described as being like a vat of blacking. James Ewan, who run the Lewis House there, evidently a little bit of a practical joker, planted boots and a hat out there to make it appear that someone were drowning in this mass of mud. And when his guests got up later, they thought they were actually seeing a man drowned on land. But people broke their arms and legs being thrown out of the wagons when they were hitting logs and the tree stumps that were left. And my grandfather, a pioneer in northern Wisconsin, tells about taking in one of these travelers and patching him up and then letting him go after nursing him back to health. Well, we came then to the first plank roads in 1848, and here we see a picture of generally what they were like. Two sills were laid, and then they put plank on top of these sills. And this was the roadbed. The planks weren't spiked down, and when we had high rain came, it washed away these planks. And they didn't last too long, of course, in the history of Wisconsin, because soon after that, the railroads take over. And after the plank road, we did more, of course, of traveling in the mud. And mud seems to have been a real problem to the early traveler in Wisconsin, and we have pictures of a horse and buggy or a traveling along in the mud, mired up to its axle. Here we have a picture of a load of hay on one of the early plank roads, and here is four horses just pulling a light wagon through this mud. And when the road, and we call it a road, became so muddy, then they just moved on out to the field and traveled in that field until that too became a mire, and then they would move again. So they were anything but stable roads on which to travel. We have some pictures too of some of the early bridges here in Wisconsin. I mentioned that this is a bridge at Princeton. You'll notice it's an early type of bridge, and there's a wooden bridge that we see at Manitowish Waters up near Rest Lake in Vilas County. And finally, a stone bridge in Whitewater. Well, this is something of the early roads here in Wisconsin, and we've followed an Indian trail until it became a military road, and a military road until it became a gravel road, and a gravel road, finally, we come to a pavement on which to travel. Near Dodgeville is this marker which tells the story of the early military road. And Herbert Quick described it, and he told about how this early road in which we traveled in oxen, cows, mules, horses, and coaches. And so the road went at first through a land of few footprints and few settlers, few sounds, no villages. But who were the people that traveled there? Oh, the early settlers, the people who came there to build Wisconsin.
This has been Wheels Across the Prairie, the story of the conveyances and roads which crossed the American prairies and Wisconsin's part in its transportation history. Next week, what they rode in. Host for the series is Dan Schutz, director of the Safety Division of the Wisconsin Motor Vehicle Department. He is assisted by Thurman Fox of the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. This series is produced by the State Historical Society of Wisconsin and WHA-TV.